Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Monday, August 27th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this evening, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a writer who you could read at the MTI blog all throughout the month. He also writes for Critcherland on Fridays, and where's the other one you write for, Peter?
Masterworks Broadway.
Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays. That's right. Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and a photographer. You can see his writing and his photography at BroadwayStars.com. You can see his photography at FollowSpotPhoto.com. Michael also writes for outlets such as Arts America and the NPR.org. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening. Thank you for joining us from vacation, James.
Absolutely. Yeah. I am joining you from Hilton Head, South Carolina, where I'm on vacation with my family. And we thought we would check in to see what was happening in the last week and what's coming up on Broadway. So Michael finally got a chance to get out to see Into the Woods. And I know that we've talked about it a few times, but, you know, Michael, what more can you say about it now that you've seen it?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say I really, you know, just a personal note to a great thank you to the press department, the press folks at the Public, because I was supposed to see the very first press performance of Into the Woods, and that was canceled because of they had problems in the tech period, largely due to so much rain that we had had, and so they had to cancel several tech rehearsals. And so they needed that night as a, you know, as an extra rehearsal. So that was canceled, and then I rescheduled for another night that where it wound up raining, and also I was not feeling well. So they actually rescheduled me twice on a beautiful, beautiful night. And you know, I mean, it's so magical to see to see really anything in the park, especially a show like this that depends largely on the foliage of the park for the set design, which, you know, I think that's been made a great point of that this production really, really capitalizes on that a lot. So I enjoyed that a lot. I had very mixed feelings about the show. There were wonderful things in it. I thought I was very impressed with Amy Adams, despite, may I use the word, the ridiculous hairstyle that she had. I assume it was a wig. I don't think it was her real hair.
Well, we better hope it is. Yeah.
yeah. I don't know why anyone made that decision. I thought that was an example of the very worst decisions that were made in the show. But I thought she was a lovely presence. I thought she had a very lovely voice. I thought she sang better than some of the people who have a lot more extensive theater backgrounds. So I was very, very happy for her. Jesse Mueller, you know, I really should learn how to pronounce her name correctly. She told me, and I keep forgetting. I think it's Mueller. I don't think it's Mueller. But anyway, the wonderful performer whom many of you saw in On a Clear Day, You Can See Forever, she was really, really terrific as Cinderella. And They were two of the big highlights for me. Donna Murphy is always, you know, as we've discussed, she is a great performer, and she certainly came through in this case as well. Other people I felt either were miscast or had certain problems. But I did want to ask Peter, because I know he wrote about this rather extensively. I'm wondering about the main concept of it, and I just, you know, aside from whether you like it or not, it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me, and I'm wondering if I'm just missing it or if it's just that it didn't make any sense. I mean, the framing device in this case is that at the very beginning of the show, you see this young boy. He looks to be about 12 or 13, would you say, Peter?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. You know, come wandering into the woods. You get the impression that it may supposed to be actually Central Park that he's wandering into, having run away from home after an argument with his father. And you hear the a few lines of the argument between them in a taped segment. And it's interesting to note, I'm not sure if many people noted this, but the voice of the father, is clearly that of Dennis O'Hare, mm-hmm. who winds up playing the baker in the show. So this kid comes into the park, and he's run away, and he takes out his backpack and pulls from it what seemed to be, and it's hard to see in a large theater like that, but various kind of action figures and dolls. Mm-hmm. Would you say that's what he pulls from his?
That's what he pulls
out.
Yeah.
And then this is sort of the impetus for the whole Into the Woods tale that then unfolds. But my main question is, I know Peter wrote a lot about how, well, what exactly is this supposed to mean? Is this supposed to mean that the kid is making up the story? And if that is the case, then, would he really make up a story so complex, with all of these incredible Sondheimian rhymes and this incredibly beautiful, complex music? So is he supposed to be making it up? Then the other question is, I hate to say it, but in the modern era, would a child of 13 or 12 really be having any interest whatsoever in Grimm's fairy tales?
None.
I think if any children still do, and I hope they do, it would probably be significantly younger children.
Yeah, because he would say, that's for babies.
Now, I understand why they didn't want to have a five-year-old wandering into Central Park, but it seemed like that was a kind of a very, very questionable concept from the get-go on the part of the director, Timothy Sheeter. But then my other question is, all right, so then the costuming of the characters is all over the place. A Little Red Riding Hood looks like something sort of like a bike messenger. She has a little helmet on, and she looks, like a sort of like a bike messenger. I can't think of any other word for it. All right. But on the other hand, and various other characters are in various other modern sorts of garb. Jack's mother, is like a modern day housefrau, and at one point she has a mink coat on. But then you have the princes dressed in what looks to all the for all the world to me like ballet costumes. Traditional ballet costumes or something that maybe characters might wear in the Metropolitan Opera production of Der Rosenkavalier. So what are we supposed to make of that? Is he imagining these characters as the modern day Manhattan equivalent of them? Or is he just imagining whatever happens to come to mind? And why would he even imagine the princes dressed in ballet costumes? I really wonder. I hate to say it, but I think this is one of those cases where someone reinterprets a show and they just throw whatever ideas come into their head at it, just to be different. And some of them work wonderfully well, and some of them really don't work at all. This goes back at least as far as the Nicholas Heitner production of Carousel, although that was, not even remotely as reinterpreted as this is. So what do you think was the concept of the show, Peter?
Well, the fact that the boy ultimately turns out to be reunited with the father at the end of the show. The father comes looking for him and finds him, and they hug, and they're reunited, and that's lovely. But I can certainly see a father having a very different reaction and yelling and screaming at the kid rather than just being happy to see him. Right. But it was very bizarre to me that this was needed, according to Sheeter and his co-director, whoever came up with what, that there was the necessity to feel that you had to bookend the idea of the father finding the child and that things work out okay in fairy tales. It made no sense to me whatsoever. Somebody in all that chat complained about something I had said. To me, it seems like the kid is awfully bright. Give him a MacArthur Genius Grant, because after all, he's coming up with this story. And somebody said, that's ridiculous. I mean, people, you just accept in musicals that people who are singing just sing, and that's all there is to it. Yeah, but here it is that he's telling the story.
Exactly.
And that, I, he's inventing the stories. We've all, as little kids, though littler than he, have pulled out our little toys and made them come to life and wrote scripts for them and all that kind of, I mean, improvised, of course, but we did scripts for them. We made our little playlists for all our toys when we were kids. Fine. But they weren't as good as Into the Woods. You know, I mean, that much is clear. So now here's what's interesting to me. On Wednesday, I went to their kiddie matinee. They were only going to do Act 1 because things get pretty severe in Act 2. And so the place was pretty full, not packed, but pretty full. And there were as many parents, of course, as there were children because somebody had to watch the kids. And most of the laughter that came from the crowd was definitely laughter from the adults. And there was very little laughter from the children. And that's not a criticism of the children. It's not even a criticism of Into the Woods. There's no question that the kids enjoyed themselves, but they didn't get all the jokes. One of the things that was fascinating to me was that three times during the show, a helicopter flew over the action. And I really paid attention to this. I didn't see one kid look up while the helicopter was flying overhead. And that's a real compliment that they were interested in what was going on. They'd seen helicopters before. They'd never seen anything like this. Now, here's what's interesting to me. The kid came out. He did dump the toys on the wood chips. But then he simply said, "Once upon a time." There was nothing about the father having strife with the father or anything like that.
You mean they cut the recording?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Wow.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
What's that all about?
Well, the idea was the kid was the narrator. And aside from throwing out the toys right away, and nothing much was made of it, it was much shorter than it was when we saw it full length. They just had him dump the toys, and really, once upon a time, we were into it. So in a way, this worked better because it almost seemed like the kid was a hired hand actor, that it didn't seem to be. He was inventing the story, almost. So that was a bit more palatable. Also, one thing that they did drop, and I knew they would. I mean, when the wolf
I'm gonna
eats
guess
Little
it was,
Red Riding yeah. when the wolf eats Little Red Riding Hood in the two-act version in this production, it's a sexual act, you know, and I knew they weren't going to do that. They couldn't, you know, and they didn't. So you don't see Little Red Riding Hood having that orgasm from that apparently deft wolf who's very good at what he does. No, here it was just Punch and Judy type stuff where from behind the headboard you saw her head pop up every now and then going, ah, you know. So that was good. You know, so, but I have to say that having a kid as a narrator doesn't necessarily bother me unless we really get the impression that this is his story that he's creating. And that's where I think it goes very, very wrong. Aside from that, if they didn't use that situation, I think, Michael, I was more enthusiastic than you about the performances. I had a good time watching the performances. Oh, another thing, by the way, at the matinee, you know, it was nice. The sunlight. Now, I always think that comedy, and I'm not the person who invented this idea, God knows, but comedy is best played in bright light. And I've always felt that Into the Woods suffered from the fact that one midnight gone, two midnights gone, all that business about midnight where it has to be dark, and the woods are dark. But, you know, during the sunlight, you know, sun does shine through the woods, and it was just so nice to see the comedy land a little better because there was sunlight. And by the way, as a theater critic who take notes, I love the fact that I had the sunlight so I could easily write on the program. I'm still smarting from the time I got something wrong when I went to see Nathan Lane in Trumbo because it was so dark in there that I couldn't see what I was writing terribly well, and I made a mistake. And boy, did he send me an email. My. Anyway, so I love that too. So anyway, it was nice to go back to Into the Woods and certainly see a different kid because two of them are playing it in rep, and also seeing the prince that had been an understudy. Now I saw the real guy, and I like the cast quite a bit, and I think Dennis O'Hare is quite funny in what he's doing. I do question the idea of the biker chick for Little Red Riding Hood, because I even overheard a little girl say, "Where's Little Red Riding Hood?" And who can blame her? You know?
Well, yeah, but more generally, Peter, what, I mean, am I wrong about the inconsistency? Is it supposed to be making a statement, the costuming?
Well, I get the impression that if a kid is doing it, anything goes. You know, I mean, a kid might think of those costumes for one person, for two people, and then other costumes for others. I mean, it's really mix and match time. The kid may be smart enough to come up with Sondheimian lyrics and pretty amazingly sophisticated story plots, but nevertheless, one could say, given the concept, that he's not a good costume designer, and it's just helter-skelter, and it's just here and there. So well, in a strange way, they get a pass on that, in a strange way.
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe you could say that if he thinks of a prince, you know, that he would maybe think of a prince as dressed.
Yeah,
like
because
that.
we don't have princes around that much. I mean, if he were in England, he might make them look like the two guys, the naked one and the other one, you know. So, so it's possible the princes have escaped his attention. He still thinks of them in fairy tale terms. So that would be the costumes.
Yeah.
So. I think back to the only other show I can think of where a child is the narrator, which was Starlight Express. But we thought that the kid in Starlight Express could pull off that.
Yeah, I did, in fact, because that was very simplistic stuff.
And, you know, even the stuff with Rocky 1, Rocky 2, Rocky 3, I still felt that that he could come up with that because those movies were rather famous and all that. So, because that was a simpler show, I didn't mind it as much. Now, but it's this is the final week. It extended to September 1st.
I think
it's going to look not so good if it does transfer, because that park is so much of an asset to it. I would hate to lose it and get a proscenium arch in a regular theater around it. It won't be nearly as interesting looking.
We should mention, because this seems like it's a technical thing and also not really a matter of opinion. There have been vociferous complaints that people sitting on, I believe, house left, have lights shining in their faces to the extent that it's painful, and they have to try to shield their eyes. It seems like a problem of focusing. The focusing was not well done, and that's both the director and the lighting designer have to answer for that. So maybe that's at least one thing that'll be improved if it does move into a proscenium theater.
Sure.
All right. Next on the agenda is Gay Camp. Michael and Peter got a chance to see it. So who wants to start us off on this?
Michael does.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of talent involved in the show. This is a production presented as part of the Fringe Festival. It was written by Philip, I won't try to pronounce it, M-U-T-Z, so Mutz or Mutz, and Susan Kate Heaney, and it was directed by Philip Fazio. And it was basically a satire of a camp that these gay boys are sent to try to turn them straight. And obviously there's a lot of fodder for both humor and drama in that kind of situation. In this case, they went for the humor. And I thought a lot of it landed, but I thought a lot of it didn't. The show was done in a very, very over-the-top style that I tend to not personally prefer. Although, it certainly was appropriate to this kind of show and this kind of humor. Also, there was a lot of scatological and sexual, very explicit sexual and scatological moments in it that I personally did not respond to at all. I tend to get turned off by that a great deal. And I didn't think it was necessary because basically, it was kind of lighthearted, the overall tone of the show, and it made its political points very well. I, to their credit, it was barely over an hour long, so they realized that this is not something that you want to beat into the ground and take a one joke thing and extend it. So they knew when to get off, as Charlie Gringas says in Marilyn Monroe. I would say that certainly it augurs well for the talents of those involved, even if some of the decisions that were made were not absolutely perfect.
All right, Peter, what'd you think?
I liked it more than that. It shouldn't be called Gay Camp, but I understand the reason why it's called Gay Camp, because a gay camp implies a camp where gays go and are accepted, that we're going to have a lot of fun activities, et cetera, et cetera.
Good
no,
point.
This is the gay. It should be called Camp Acceptance, because that's exactly what we're talking about. That's the name of the camp, and indeed, they do not want gay kids to remain gay. They want to straighten them out. In fact, one line is, sitting up straight is the first step to being straight. Yeah, and you know, when you think of it, that's about as logical as anything else we ever hear from the movements that believe that they can so-called straighten people out and so-called cure them of their so-called disease/illness. So it did make a lot of nice points about that and how futile that entire movement is, that it's ridiculous. It's also interesting that there was a joke about the Nymph Festival in the show, as well as a Chick-fil-A joke.
Yes, it was really, 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 really up to the moment, and lots of discussion of Rick Santorum.
Sure, the next thing I was going to say. So that was pretty good too. It was one of those shows done by three people that you swear as you're watching it, there's more than three people, and that's the greatest compliment you can give to Philip Mutz, Ken Urso, and Christian Mansfield, as well as director Philip Fazio. They really did exemplary work in exits, entrance, disguises, costumes that. Really, when only three people came out of the curtain call, you said, oh, gee, wow, yeah, that's right. It was only three people. Really, you could have assumed there were four or five. And that's one of the greatest things that you can say about this. I hope this show continues. It may not have a commercial life, but I'd like to see it crop up here and there, because I think it can do a lot of good for those people who really do believe that so-called curing homosexuality is an easy and achievable thing to do if only they would cooperate. You know, please, come on. It's really stupid to feel otherwise, and Gay Camp underlined that very well, and I was very glad I attended. My hat's off to everybody for doing as well as they did.
Well, that's great.
So that's played at the Fringe.
Yeah, I don't know if they got an encore. We're now at the point where some of them are getting encore performances. I don't know if
it wasn't in the list of the first ones that they announced, but I don't know if that was a complete list of the encores.
All right, so if we see it coming around again, maybe we'll see if it takes on another life post-Fringe. But it's always good to see these nuggets come out of the Fringe.
Question though, Peter, specifically, did the some of the extreme sexual content, did that not bother you? It would be interesting if it bothered the gay guy and not the straight guy.
Gee, frankly, whatever it says about me, I don't even remember it.
Oh, okay.
Nor do I remember the scatological stuff you're talking about, and I'm not saying you're wrong. Or
well,
maybe
scatological is the wrong. There was just none of it. I should hasten to mention none of it was depicted, but there was discussion of of very graphic discussion of specific sexual practices.
I can't say that I remember that. I wish it well.
Great.
All right. In the news, we. See that Motown the Musical has announced that it's going to be opening at the Lunfontein on Sunday, April 14th, 2013, which is the end of this current season, but it's still, many months away. It's interesting that we got this, these announcements are starting to roll in right now. So Kevin McCollum's producing it along with Doug Morris and Berry Gordy, and it's going to be... I'm imagining a jukebox musical of Motown's songs. What do you guys think about this?
Well, what I find...
Go ahead, Michael. No.
Oh,
go.
Well, I find it fascinating that... I mean, the most fascinating thing is that Diana Ross is a major character in it. And I just wonder at the legality, the legal questions involved in that. I mean, Berry Gordy is also, but I guess... One tends to think of Miss Ross as someone who would be very concerned about how she would be portrayed in any kind of fictional work. And, you know, hence Dreamgirls not really being about the Supremes, even though it is. Mm-hmm. So that really interests me a lot.
One of the smartest things Dreamgirls did was mention the Supremes in the book. You know, well, what about the Supremes? You know, and that way that diffused any legal suit, because after all, by saying, mentioning Supremes, well, therefore the Dreams couldn't have been the Supremes,
right.
You know, even though we, so that was a very clever way out of it, because it wasn't like they worried about, well, is the audience going to be confused? No, the audience knew. Everybody knew this was the story of the Supremes. But, well, what's interesting to me, though, is that Berry Gordy is a producer. And I think
right.
that could mean trouble. Because the problem with these hands-on people who are still alive is that they want things a certain way. And things tend to get watered down when that happens. One of the best things about Jersey Boys, and I'll admit the Jersey Boy guys, most of them were around, one of the best things about Jersey Boys is that they really let you think, it may be true, it may not, that you're seeing the truth. Early on, they tell you somebody went to jail. Early on, they told you they broke into a church, you know, things like that. And because they weren't just talking about lollipops and roses type stuff, you started to believe what you were hearing, because
right.
they had given you some dirty facts at the beginning. I don't know if Berry Gordy, or as you say, of course, Diana Ross, is going to like that. And one of the reasons Lennon wasn't more interesting is because Yoko Ono was there saying, no, don't talk about his affairs, you know, don't do that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's always hard. Margaret Stein, Julie Stein's widow, was telling me that what Funny Girl was happening, they were really hamstrung because Ray Stark's wife was Fanny Bryce's daughter, and she didn't want it coming out that actually Fanny was already married when she met Nick Arnstein, that she knew he was no good, that she used to shill for him when he was gambling. No, I want none of that in my mother's story. And as a result, Funny Girl is a pretty dull story. It's a pretty predictable story. In fact, Isabel Lennart wrote it very well, but the plot that she was given and had to deal with was the trite part of it. The dialogue is really very good in Funny Girl.
Mm,
it's just
yeah.
the story isn't. So so under those circumstances, it's always hard when a living person is there. And if he's a producer, he's going to have a lot to say. So I adore Kevin McCollum. I think he's a phenomenal producer. He's done amazing work in a reasonably short time. I wish him well under these circumstances, but I think he's taken on a handful.
Yeah, it's I'm looking through the press release here, and directly from the press release, it said Motown the Musical, based on the life of legendary Motown founder Berry Gordy. So you take that sentence, and it's being produced by Berry Gordy. He lists himself as a legendary Motown founder, Berry Gordy, and well, he is legendary
sure.
in the amazing things that he did.
Oh, yeah,
but
you know.
For somebody to bill themselves as that, and then it says directed by Charles Randolph Wright, Motown the Musical will feature a book by Berry Gordy and music and lyrics from the Motown legendary catalog. Anything interesting here? No.
Oh, I missed the book by Berry Gordy.
So he's got the book there, and the writers can shut down a Broadway show. You know, people don't realize that in essence almost have more power than a producer.
Sure.
Even if he wasn't a producer, he could have really exerted a lot of influence over this. I think that they're really counting on this catalog.
I agree.
Oh, sure.
The
sure.
exhilarating show charts Motown founder Berry Gordy's incredible journey from featherweight boxer to the heavyweight music mogul who launched the careers of Diana Ross and the Supremes, Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5, Stevie Wonder, The Temptations, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles and Marvin Gaye, and many more. So
that's a good lineup, no question. And it's a better lineup than we had with Baby It's You.
Sure.
But Baby It's You should have done better. And it didn't, because the story was weak. And as a result, I think we may be facing a weak story here. But another profound difference is that's a golden word, Motown. I mean, that is a word that does drive people interest. So as a result, I predict better than Baby It's You. But I don't necessarily predict a good show.
Well, I think it's interesting. Don't you think that the success of Memphis has a lot to do with this?
Mm-hmm.
And so it will be interesting to see, hopefully some portrayal of the actual thing that actually happened in the wake of Memphis. But it is so interesting, especially when you're dealing with living people. I mean, I guess maybe their feeling is that the story of the just the professional aspect of it is so interesting that they don't really need to get into whatever dark, areas might exist in the personal lives of Berry Gordy and Diana Ross and whoever. But it really depends, from case to case. It's interesting that you brought up Funny Girl, Peter, because I think in addition to everything you said, I remember reading that Nick Arnstein was still alive.
Yes, he was.
When the play version of Funny Girl was written anyway. So that was something else they had to contend with.
Now,
well, as I understand, I remember in Time magazine he was quoted saying, I've been told by my lawyers not to talk about it so my blood pressure can keep low. And that was that's almost a direct quote, because I remember it vividly in Time magazine. So I don't know exactly why that was the case, that they could say anything they wanted about him. Or did Nicky Arnstein feel that he got off lightly? Because they weren't saying the Fanny was shilling for him, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe, he felt that too.
Well, we've discussed this before, and it's interesting to me. I guess it really depends from case to case, because I really do not have a clear picture of how much one can get away with when writing about a quote-unquote public figure.
Sure.
And I think there have been lawsuits. I know there have been lawsuits in certain cases, but in other cases, it seems like there haven't been. So I don't know if it was all hammered out ahead of time, with the discussion with the parties involved, or if some people just felt it wasn't worth suing, or they didn't feel that they needed to sue because they didn't feel that they were portrayed in a negative light. I'm sure it varies very much from case to case.
Well, that famous expression that every great fortune begins with a great crime, which has been attributed to Balzac and a few other people too. I was wondering about that when I was writing about the Rothschilds recently. And I remember asking Sheldon Harnick and saying, no, they were fine, but again, you can find anything on the internet, pro and con. And I found so much about the fact that the story of the Rothschilds and how they succeeded was not as benign as the way Sherman Yellen made it seem in the musical in 1970. I like the story of the Rothschilds as we have it, but again, I have no idea. I guess I would have a better idea if I did read Frederick Morton's book, which is something I guess I'll do one of these days. But one wonders, exactly how much things are played with. I was writing about Parade recently, and I found a fact that wasn't consistent with what happens in the show. I'll think about it and I'll come back to that. But anyway.
Well, I wanted to ask. I wanted to ask about the viability of a Motown musical, because Broadway is mostly a white audience, and Jersey Boys is a white audience, and Memphis is a white audience.
Those records, a lot of white people bought those records.
Absolutely, but
yeah,
but in couching it towards. Motown being the big name there, and the relationship between Berry Gordy and Diana Ross, it seems like it would be geared towards somebody from Ohio is not going to go see this. Is that just my take on it, or
well,
I think so, James.
Go ahead. I mean, are you saying, James, that Memphis was different because it had white people in it, so the white audience was able to get into the story through the white characters?
Not really that, as much as from a marketing standpoint, Memphis.
Oh, okay.
Memphis and Jersey Boys and various other musicals—they're really marketed white, and I'm thinking of Fila, had a little bit of a healthy run, but really not a huge commercial success. And perhaps the Porgy and Bess is not really...
No, it hasn't.
Oh, but I don't know. I think it's completely different. I mean, these people we're talking about, the Motown acts are just world famous.
Absolutely.
Crossover, you know, artists who were...
Let's assume that maybe a white audience is going to come to Motown the Musical. Is it going to be a way to introduce a non-traditional audience to Broadway, or... do we think that that's going to be a failure or successful?
I think the audience that Motown is going to attract has already been coming to Broadway.
Okay.
I think it's the baby boomer generation who certainly made Smokey Joe's Cafe a big success. If there's one thing baby boomers like, it's to feel young, and music makes you feel young, and that's their music. So as a result, I think there is going to be an audience based on the music alone. How much the story sinks it is another question entirely, but they have a very good chance to succeed with really as simple as that six letter word is. I mean, that's money in the bank.
One
thing we can get down on our our knees and thank whatever God we pray to is that this is not being written by those people who wrote Million Dollar Quartet and Baby It's You, because it seemed like for a while they had the market cornered on these bio rock musicals. But as I think I may have mentioned before, those are two of the worst books in the history of musical theater. So I don't think that Barry Gordy in his worst moment, and even if he has not an iota of talent, could do any worse than those two books. So we can at least be thankful for that. And I hate to show my ignorance. Does Motown Records still exist?
Yes, it does.
All right, well, then maybe we'll have the cast album on that, because the only other one is Pippin that I know of.
Isn't this something how Pippin wound up on Motown Records? You're quite right. It certainly did.
I'm reading today, Peter. Did you know this? Somebody on, I think it was on the cast recordings page on Facebook, or maybe it was elsewhere, but somebody claimed that the orchestrations that you hear on the cast album of Pippin are completely different from the actual show orchestrations, because it was redone basically, as a quote-unquote pop album. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. No, I never heard that.
I didn't either. Oh. I should check that out.
We should ask John Rubenstein.
Yes.
Yeah.
He would know.
Yeah.
He would. All right. Well, let's move forward and talking about cast recordings. We have very sad news that the Colony Record Store is going to be closing up, and... we talked earlier this summer about Dress Circle closing in London. The last of the great Broadway-themed stores are heading out. Do you have any great stories about Colony?
It was a great place to kill time before a show, but with the prices they were asking, it was really quite terrible. I wish I could be more mournful of this, but the fact is, it did seem to me that they were terrible price gougers, and that the people who worked there weren't the nicest. So I wish I could be more enthusiastic about them, and I wish I could feel bad for them. I like the idea of a music store right there on Broadway and 49th. Yes, indeed. And I will miss going by the windows and seeing what's displayed there. But I have never in my life ever bought a single thing in Colony. And given the fact that down the street, for a while anyway, we did have HMV in Times Square, which did offer discounts. I mean, and look where it got them. I mean, Colony lasted longer, no question about it. But I feel so bad for unsuspecting tourists who come out of a show and want to buy the album and have to pay $25 or more for a CD that they could get for so much less in so many other ways. So... I'll tell you, every now and then I have a question about a sheet music, gee, what tempo is that in? It was nice to saunter in there, pick up the book, look, find out my answer, and leave. But if they were a competitive store, they certainly would have had my business.
Felicious speaks the truth again.
Well, as I perceive
Michael,
it anyway.
I think they were great.
Did you shop there?
I not only did I... I have shopped there in the past. Wow. Nothing, not recently, but uh-huh. also, you know, when I was producing CDs, I would actually sell to Colony. And
all right.
It was different a very story. Difficult racket, and the prices were ridiculous, and the people were not very nice. Absolutely, you are 100% correct. I wholeheartedly agree with you. I also agree that I wish that there was something there that wasn't, you know, wouldn't kill the tourists who walked in and buy a cast album for $50. You know, it was kind of ridiculous, but.
Well, I mean, I think they were great for two things. They were great for the sheet music, and they were great for really obscure, you know, out of print cast mm-hmm. albums. And also, I think they tend to have a lot of foreign cast albums also. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I mean, to go in for any other reason was just silly. Although, one more thing. I'm sorry. Back in the day, they were famous. For getting things before anyone else, for whatever reason, I don't know how they did it, but they would have recordings before anyone else did. And I remember distinctly going to buy an opera recording there, actually, that I was waiting for. I could not wait to get it, and I paid through the nose, you know. But I got it before anyone else did. So, you know, if that's worth it for you, then that's what it was there for. But nowadays, you know, I think that people are just too savvy. You know, even tourists, quote unquote. You know, they know that they should not have to pay $40-$50 for a CD of a cast album that you know they can get the CD cheaper, or they can just download it. So I think that's just the march of time that kind of and technology that caught up with them. I have one very negative story. I hadn't gone in there in years, and then I wandered in with some friends about 2 years ago, maybe less. And we're looking around, and they have, aside from everything else, they have these window cards kind of for various things. And there was a window card for Judy Garland at the Eurus Theater. And I was like, wait a minute. Didn't the Eurus Theater open?
Sure.
Several years after,
72, right.
So I thought maybe it was me, maybe I'm wrong, maybe my memory is wrong. So I went home and I checked, and of course I was right. It opened in 72, and she died in 69. Right. So yeah. I actually called up, I called up the store, and I said to some fellow, I said, you know, what is this thing you're selling, you know, and he hemmed and he hawed, and I said, well, you know, it's bogus, it's bogus merchandise, it's not real, and I think it calls into question everything else you're selling. And he's like, oh, I'm very proud of this store and blah blah blah, and he got very defensive. And I'm like, well, fine, but just so you know, if I walk in and see something like that, it, you know, it's even less reason for me ever to walk in there ever again. So that wow. was my very, very negative last impression of of Colony.
All right, let's move forward. Other things in the news: that Sony Pictures is looking towards Broadway. There was an article in the New York Times that Patrick Healy wrote that Sony bought a 20% stake in Scott Sanders' theatrical productions. And
right.
And so it could be that Sony is gearing itself towards, you know, sort of a Disney push to get some of their properties on Broadway.
Including Tootsie,
yeah.
Yeah, not a bad idea for a show, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean,
No,
I was amazed how many people I've read say, oh, no, a musical of Tootsie. Oh, my God, why not? I think it's a perfectly decent property to be adapted into a musical. Of course, taint what you do. It's the way that you do it, and we'll see who gets the job. But nevertheless, I don't see any problem with Tootsie itself. Of course, I have to admit that I always rail against people who say, oh, we have all these movies being made into musicals. There's nothing wrong with that. If they're well done, who cares where they come from? Musicals have always been adaptations more often than not. So we're in more of a movie age than a book age. So that's what people go to adapt. I don't see any problem with it whatsoever. So so I wish Tootsie well. I hope they get the right people to do it, though.
Yeah.
On a somewhat related note, I think they are now in the midst of or soon to have open call auditions for the film of Jersey Boys.
Yeah, I did see that, yeah.
So yeah. If you feel like you are up to it, you know, check that out, because who knows? I mean, you know, who knows if they would ever cast anyone from an open call? But you know, the chance exists. That's why the American Dream, right? Or part of
it is. But and also, John Lloyd Young was definitely famous until he got the part. So maybe lightning can strike again.
True.
I wonder if John Lloyd Young's coming back into Jersey Boys is sort of a brush up or an audition for the movie.
Yeah, well, that occurred to
point,
me too.
But you know, I mean, the camera is pretty unforgiving in determining age. So, and I'm not saying that John Lloyd Young is an old man by any stretch of any imagination, but you know, time has gone on, and I don't think he's going to look like a boy. I think he would look like a Jersey man on the camera.
Justin Bieber is Frankie Valli.
Could happen. Could happen.
All right. Coming up in a couple of weeks is September 4th through the 16th is Broadway Week, which is sort of like 2 weeks, isn't it? Where
That's
we fine. Have half-price tickets for a handful of Broadway shows. And I think this is a great tradition that's a number of years happening now. I just wanted to mention it so that if you are a listener from outside the area or even inside the area, you want to catch a few shows, even once is being offered through Broadway Week. There's the once tickets are not they're partial views and a little bit obstructed, but at least you get to see the show.
That's
and,
right.
And it's a very hard ticket to get, and you're getting it at a discount. So looking forward to that happening for September 4th through the 16th. Last thing that we want to talk about tonight happened after we recorded last is that Phyllis Diller passed away. And Peter and Michael both want to say a little something. So Peter, why don't you talk about Phyllis for a second?
I liked Phyllis quite a bit. I got to know her slightly, and when David Merrick died, she was the first person I called to get a quotation, and I remember vividly going over to my editor at the Star-Ledger and saying, all right, I've got a quote from Phyllis Diller. Phyllis Diller, what does she have to do with David Merrick? It is hard to believe, you know, that she was on Broadway doing Hello, Dolly, but indeed she was. I did not see her, but I will tell you this. I have never met a human being who saw her who said she was anything but terrific. Everybody that I know personally thought she was quite wonderful. And I asked her about this, and she said, well, the one thing I did do was not be Phyllis Diller at all. I really played Dolly Levi. That was something I really wanted to do. And anybody I've brought this up to has said, yes, she did. Yes, she did. She was not Phyllis Diller at all. So I give her credit for doing that, because how many entertainers come in and really believe all they have to be is themselves. That's what people want to see, and in fact would be disappointed if they didn't see them. So so that was kind of interesting. Also, my girlfriend, who's a book agent, had wonderful experiences with her, because my girlfriend sold her memoir, still available, Lampshade in a Whorehouse is the funky name of it, and really was dealing with her very close to her death, because they still kept in touch even though the book had come out and all this business. And while they never met face to face, Phyllis Diller was terrific to work with, Linda says. And not only that, but she was very generous to the person who actually was the as told to guy, and very generous indeed. So so I'm sorry that this happened, but of course, living into the 90s is a very nice and long life. So we're glad that she was around for as long as she was. I don't know if you've ever seen, there's an episode of You Bet Your Life, the Groucho Marx quiz show, when they announced this. And today we have with us, you know, our next people to come on are so-and-so and Phyllis Diller. And nobody's making anything of anything. You know, she comes on, Groucho says, well, tell me about you. You know, and she actually did that show before she became famous. So if you ever see any of the reruns of You Bet Your Life, look for that one. It's really flabbergasting to see her come out and just be, you know, John Q. Public, Jane Q. Public, without any fame or fortune or anything yet. So she did get a late start in life, but boy, she made it count.
Mm. All righty, Michael.
Well, I don't have much to add. I also, unfortunately, did not see her in Hello, Dolly, but I'll never forget seeing a clip on TV of her singing Before the Parade Passes By. I don't remember what show it was. I'll never remember. And she was fantastic. I mean, I for whatever reason, I had no idea that she could sing so well. I mean, because she didn't focus on that. Sure. So that was A, you know, and then plus B, as Peter said, I also have never heard anyone who saw her say that she was anything less than fantastic. One can only imagine how funny she was, you know, plus the voice, which I didn't know she had, but she did. I really would have loved to have seen her in that. I think she was, wasn't she right before Merman?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, she was the second to last. I think so. Mm-hmm. And I don't think she did it that long. But that I may try to suss out. I recently become acquainted with someone who has access to, bootleg recordings. But listen, you know, in a case like that where there's no, you know, there's no commercial version of it, I hope we can all agree that for historical value,
I thoroughly agree.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong, especially
nothing at all.
Yeah,
because if these things were available, we'd buy them. If they say, hey, you know, there's not enough market for it, well, then we have to create our own market. So I have no apologies whatsoever for any bootleg recordings.
I'm glad you agree.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if somebody goes to Phantom of the Opera with a tape recorder to save $20, or in Colony's case, $85, to not buy the original cast album, cut off his hands. But, I mean, somebody who really wants something that isn't available otherwise, as they say in How to Succeed, well, really, what's the harm?
Exactly. Oh, somebody recently posted a clip of Barbara Streisand with Phyllis Diller on might have been Jack Parr or Orson Bean, and Phyllis was a very early champion of Barbara. They worked together, I think, at the Bonsoir or one of those clubs. Oh. I mean, they're on the same bill, you know, not together. And she apparently was also a very generous artist, and many people recently, including Joan Rivers, have hailed her as a trailblazer and a very, very supportive and generous colleague. So yeah, she really was. She's one of the last of that breed. You know, I mean, we keep saying that, but there really are not many left that old time showbiz. You know, wonderfully multi-talented people like that who came up in that era. So, yeah, she was amazing.
All righty. So anything you guys have coming up this week that we should be aware about?
I'm finishing my book. It's got to be passed in Friday. I'll be ready. I'm doing it.
Great.
So that's my story. So I'm seeing nothing.
Michael, any plans for this holiday weekend coming up?
Well, I am seeing a few things. I'm seeing a show at Feinstein's called Love Songs. Oh, and then I'm seeing a show that I really am looking forward to. It's called Patty Issues.
Yeah, Ben Rimmelauer.
Yes, Ben Rimmelauer, who's a very, very talented person. And he is. Doing a show at the Duplex about... can I say his obsession with Patti LuPone?
Or yeah.
Just yeah, his interest.
And then I'm going to, I guess, one of the first press performances of the new Forbidden Broadway, which had a really fantastic article in the New York Times today that I think has many people really salivating about that. I think many, many, many of us are really looking forward to the return, and I'm very excited about that.
All righty, great. So I guess we should wrap it up right now. It's as you mentioned at the top of the podcast, I am coming to you from Hilton Head, South Carolina, and so I'm going to get back to my family, and I guess we will speak to everybody next week. We're going to come to you again Monday night because it is a holiday weekend. Next week is Labor Day here in the United States, as we do have an international audience. I apologize because I very often make either only U.S.-centric references or even New York-centric references or even an Upper West Side-centric reference that nobody else will get. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.